Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we talk with Ken Bloom. We also talk about in the news, After Midnight is closing, whether Honeymoon in Vegas is coming in. The Tony Awards decide that sound is not a category to be had anymore. Also, the City Center Encores announces their season. Plus, we review Rigantino at City Center and Fly By Night at Playwrights Horizons. Please stay tuned.
Don't you know me? I'm the new bad in war, baby. Try and tear me down. I was born on the other side of a town ripped in two. Try and tear me down. You want me, baby, I dare you. Try and tear me down.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio. This week on Broadway for Sunday, June 15th, 2014. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning are Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Kritzerland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, The Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many other places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
All right, so it is a happy Father's Day to everybody out there who is a father or has a father.
Yes.
I guess that would be almost
that. I guess that covers
that
it.
That covers it, yes. With us this morning, we have a special guest. Ken Bloom is with us. He's a director, author, musical theater historian, and just all around walking encyclopedia of everything that we ever needed to know about Broadway and musical theater. Ken, welcome.
Hi, thanks.
Thanks for coming on a Sunday morning. So you have a new show happening up at the Town Hall called The Ambassador Review. So why don't you tell us about that?
Well, this is really an old show that we've just rediscovered. It's by Cole Porter, and it was first done in Paris in 1928 and lost for the next 85 years.
Jeez.
Some listeners may know the song Pilot Me, because Bobby Short recorded it. But otherwise, none of these songs have been heard. And indeed, in 2012, in Milan, we found some of the music. And this year, in State College, Pennsylvania, we found the remainder of the music, plus an unknown song, plus the original orchestrations. So really, this is the first time anyone has heard this show in its entirety, which is pretty astounding.
In State College, Pennsylvania, so Penn State University or somebody off campus?
No, Penn State in the Fred Waring collection.
I've been there, yeah.
Yeah, Fred Waring was the band leader of the show in Paris.
Oh.
In Paris, it was all American performers that they shipped over, and including Frances Gershwin, George Gershwin's sister, who sang a Gershwin medley in the middle of the show.
Wow.
So we're going to do a Porter medley in the middle of the show instead of the Gershwin medley.
So are you going to get to call it the new musical from Cole Porter, as they did with Crazy for You, the new Gershwin musical?
No, because we're really doing it exactly as done. The exception of we have no specialty numbers. They have specialty numbers of eccentric dancers, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Although we do four dancers choreographed by Randy Skinner, who's a three-time Tony Award nominee for White Christmas and 42nd Street and other shows.
Sure. So,
what was it? When No No Nanette was revived on Broadway, they called it the new 1925 musical. Maybe you could go something along those lines.
Exactly.
All right. Now, this is an important building block in Cole Porter's career, right?
Absolutely. He didn't have successes until this show. This show was his first big success. And then he went on to 50 Million Frenchmen, you know, Anything Goes, and other shows. So this was really the start of him really getting acceptance.
Uh-huh. And any idea why it didn't come here way back when?
Well, first of all, it was a musical review, And I think that it just didn't get a lot of press in the United States. None of the songs were imported. There were no American recordings of the score. And I remember Howard Dietz, the lyricist, told me, once the show is up, you are on to the next show, which is one reason people didn't save music and scripts and all of those shows, because there were no revivals. So the show was just never done anywhere else. It was really specific for a nightclub in Paris.
One doesn't associate Fred Waring with nightclubs. He seemed to be a very four-square type of orchestra leader, very middle-of-the-road, white bread. Am I right?
Very four-square back in the 1950s when we remembered him from television.
Sure.
But in the 1920s, he was really jazzy, really jazzy. And, in fact, he did a movie named Syncopation, which gives you an idea. He was really a hot player. And when you hear these orchestrations, they're just incredibly way out. I mean, really way out. And really with that 20s sound, but the original one, not the 20s sound that we hear on Broadway with Crazy for You and other 20s musicals that have all the cliches.
So in essence, what we're talking about is he was sort of like the music version of Mary Martin, who was hot once and then got respectable.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Well,
so this this is part of a whole series of things happening at the town hall for the summer. It's a, I guess, Friday, June 27th. I almost read that incorrectly. The June 27th is your kickoff there.
That's right.
So how long have you been working on this, and how did you pull it all together?
Well, it all goes back to 2011. Amy Burton, who was a New York City opera singer, was going to do a club act with songs by Cole Porter, and she invited myself and Barry Kleinbort to listen to some of the songs, and Robert Kimball had sent her one of the songs from this show that was published. There are only five songs published in sheet music, I think. And we got curious. So I called my friend Christophe Mirambeau, who's the French expert on all things musical theater in France, and he's the one who found the music in Milan in the Universal Music Archives.
Wow.
So in 2012, I helped out on a big Paris version of the show with, let's see, it was 30-member orchestra, 40 people in the chorus, and four principals, and new orchestrations by Larry Blank, since there were no orchestrations that we could find.
Right.
Then I had the idea to do it here, but in a real 20s style. Originally, we were going to do it in a nightclub setting, but the show is so big, because we have 18 pieces, I think, in the orchestra now.
That's great.
Four tap dancers, five principals. So we're doing it at a town hall with the original orchestration. And then we found the additional music and all. It's amazing.
So what about recording this? Is there any talk about it?
Well, we are going to record it, and it's going to be released on my record label, which is Harbinger Records.
Mm-hmm.
We should talk about the cast. We haven't mentioned the cast yet.
So Amy Burton is in it, who's been with the project from the beginning. Tom Wopat, who we all know, he's a three-time Tony Award nominee. Anita Gillette, who people probably know either now from television, but she was in a lot of Broadway shows. And Catherine Russell, who's a jazz singer who's really great. And then we have four tap dancers.
Whoops, Jason Graff.
And Jason Graff.
Yes.
Who's our comic lead. Sorry, Jason.
Who's everywhere lately.
Yeah, I know, he is. He's ubiquitous. But he's because he's really good.
That's why.
So, Ken, how do you manage the different hats that you wear all the time, from author to director to historian? Do you find that this pulls you in different directions, or is this all additive to the to your work?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I do these books which are about these shows, and I know about the show. Then we do a concert version of the show. Then we do a record on the record label. So it's all sort of mixed in together, and it's just a balancing act. I just have to keep lists of things to do and figure out when I'm doing what. That's the thing. You just have to keep up.
And then you were pulling this material together, and you brought it to Town Hall, or did Town Hall
That's
approach
right.
you?
Vince had done a big success for Town Hall. That was a recreation of the Benny Goodman Carnegie Hall concert. And so Town Hall was like, what else do you have? And Vince and I had talked about this show, so Town Hall said they were really interested, because how many times do you get to premiere an unknown show by a major American composer?
Really? Well, I think, you know, Vince Giordano and the Nighthawks, I think, you know, I'm so pleased by their popularity. I think that's a wonderful thing, and I'm glad that it keeps going. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, they're amazing. You know, they're doing Boardwalk Empire. They do movies. It's astounding. You have no idea how busy Vince is. Plus, he appears every Monday and Tuesday at the Iguana restaurant on 54th Street. So he's like me. You know, we're all over the place all the time.
But if the show starts in Paris and it's written by an American composer lyricist, how did Milan get into this?
It was originally published by the French publisher Salabert, and Universal acquired Salabert in their, you know, corporate,
wisdom?
No, corporate plan to take over the world. So they bought all these different European publishers, and they decided to put all their archives together in Milan for some reason. So that's where the music was. And the song we found was in Cole Porter's hand. That's
wow.
the amazing
really?
Thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
I guess rental space is cheaper in Milan than Paris, so I guess that makes sense.
I guess that must be it.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. If I was an archivist and I was going into some corporate meeting, I would look at them square in the eye and say, I think you need to send me to Milan for a few years. You know?
Good point.
Now, Ken, this may be a stupid question, but would that be essentially the same Universal music that exists today?
Yeah. It's Universal music here also.
Wow.
They have a big music publishing arm, and they're really huge in Europe.
Yes, yeah, wow.
Remember, there was an owner who was French at one time.
Yeah.
So
well,
Ken,
it wouldn't be called Universal if it wasn't. So
that's right.
This is true. Ken, you, I think that you hail from D.C. Is that the correct?
I do.
That
I
correct
do.
Area? How did yes. you? How did you make your way from D.C. to New York?
Well, I was working at New Playwrights Theater of Washington, which I co-founded back in the 70s. Remember the 1970s?
Yeah, sure.
And I had a radio show on WKCR, Broadway Musicals radio show. And I don't know, I just felt it was time to leave Washington. And Karen Hopkins, who's now president of BAM, she was working in New Playwrights. And we decided to move up together, basically. So we both came here, and I started working for NPR for All Things Considered and Morning Edition. And while there, I met this guy who had a publishing company, and I did the first edition of my book, American Song. And that was it, you know.
And so, and you founded Harbinger, and now it is 30-some-odd years.
Over 40 years, actually.
Over 40 years.
Yeah. Bill Rudman is my partner in Harbinger. He's in the Cleveland office. I'm in the New York national office. And we have no overhead, which is how we've lasted so long. It's
cute.
My apartment, Bill's apartment. We never get paid. We just want to keep this music alive. And we just did this 2-CD set of Sheldon Harnick's music with a 60-page book that he wrote, annotations about all his songs.
Oh, how fantastic.
So that's been a big success, which I'm happy to say, because it's his 90th birthday.
Well, it is worth the price simply for the song called Mr. A, in which he and Jerry Bock wrote about their affection for Mr. Abbott. George Abbott, and he does a very clever lyric thing towards the end. So just for that alone, that Sheldon Harnick said it's
right.
worth it. But there are plenty of other treats.
Yeah, the two CDs are really mostly from demos. So you'll hear a lot of songs that no one's ever heard before, which is very, very exciting. I think the only famous song we have is Sunrise Sunset. Is that right, Peter?
I think so, yeah.
All the others are pretty much unknown.
Mm-hmm. So how did you come up with the name Harbinger Records?
I don't know. It was Bill's idea, and I went along. Who knows? A harbinger of things to come, I guess.
Right.
I don't know.
That works for me. So that's great. I will include a link to the Town Hall website where you can purchase tickets to the Ambassador Review, which is Friday, June 27th, 2014 at 8 p.m. Thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you all.
All right. Have a great day.
Okay. You
Bye-bye.
Too.
Bye. Bye.
So is it me, or has it just seemed that there are so fewer Renaissance men like Ken out there these uh-huh. days? You know, I don't
yeah,
know what... I don't know what it is. If people have to specialize really in one field these days to get any major achievements in life, it's harder to do so many different things all at once. So, people that try to do too many things all at once. Rugantino at City Center is a Italian musical that has. Now graced our shores, and Peter and Michael got a chance to see it. So,
if you want, I was thinking maybe I could just start only because I maybe with the help with the pronunciations.
Sure, absolutely. So, so Michael, why don't you start with it?
I mean, but then I'll stop, and then I'll let Peter go.
Okay,
you're gonna have to stop.
You're gonna lay the groundwork for us.
All right. So, so the star of this production is Enrico Brignano, who apparently is a very very big. Comedy star, I guess musical comedy star, but mostly comedy in Italy. And one of his credits that I read, one that we would know, is that he was the voice of Olaf in the Italian version of the film Frozen. Olaf, I believe, is the snowman.
Yes.
Yeah.
He's the snowman.
Right.
Jonathan Groff played.
No, no. At first I thought it was Jonathan's character. It's the guy from Book of Mormon.
Yeah.
Josh Gad.
Yeah.
So that is something that if anyone has seen or plans to see the Italian version of Frozen, you will hear Enrico Brignano as Olaf. But of course, he's got many, many other credits in Italy that most of us wouldn't know anything about. And then let's see. The book and lyrics for this show are by Pietro Garinei and Sandro Giovannini. And the music is by Armando Trovaioli, I guess. Trovaioli. Book in collaboration with Pasquale Festa Campanile and Massimo Franciosa. And the original directors are Pietro Garinei and Sandro Giovannini. And mise en scène is the credit, is Enrico Brignano, the star. So I guess that means he's sort of directing a production that was originally directed by these other people. Oh, and the choreographer is Gino Landi. Yeah, I guess I'll let Peter take it. Let me just say, as a way of opening, I really was very interested in this because I only basically knew the title and the fact that it was a show that an Italian musical that played in Italian on Broadway very briefly in the 60s, courtesy of Alex Cohen, who brought it to the Mark Hellinger Theater. And that's basically what I knew about it. I figured I'd go in cold because I knew it was going to have, titles. And my Italian is okay, but it's certainly not nearly good enough to follow a whole show in Italian. But I guess the first thing that really surprised me, and in retrospect maybe it shouldn't, was that there was no live orchestra. They were singing to tracks. And in some cases, I think like maybe the chorus vocals were also on tracks. I think all of the solo vocals were live. But that was a big disappointment to me. And I understand the costs involved. And it was a very huge cast. And the sets were very lavish and beautiful. And the costumes. But it's just... And somehow it surprised me even more that with something coming from Italy, you know, I just associate Italy with music and live music. And I wouldn't think that would be something that they'd want to do. So I was very surprised at that. And then I turned out to be greatly surprised by the length of the show. But that's where I'll let Peter take over, if he would.
Yeah, the first act ended at 10 o'clock, and it didn't start particularly late either, from an 8 o'clock curtain.
Right.
I love this original cast album, and I've been listening to it quite a bit over the years. I've even had it put on CD, even though it hasn't been officially released on CD. I like the album so much that I did have a friend burn it for me on a CD. And really, I mean, I don't think a year goes by that I don't play it, which I can't say for many of my other cast albums. So it's really quite beautiful music, and it really suggests, especially when you hear a guillotine come down at the end of the record, that this is a serious musical play. Not at all. This is a show that's really out for the comedy, low comedy, commedia dell'arte comedy, a little bit mixed in too. But here's the story. Rigantino is a scamp, a scoundrel, a womanizer. And one of the problems was that the gentleman playing the role didn't look like a chick magnet to me, I'll tell you. I can't imagine women really falling in love, drop-dead attraction to him when they first see him, but that's another story. Somebody today compared him to a thinner Zero Mostel. Does that sound like somebody who would really be a ladies' man? Not to me, but anyway. The problem is that we can't really like this guy. He's a terrible human being. Terrible. Mm. One of the things he does, which he thinks is funny, is when people are having a wake in their home, and people used to have wakes in their home, they're in mourning, he picks up a dead cat and throws it in their window. Now, what type of person does something like that? That's supposed to be funny. Not to me, it isn't. The real problem, though, was the fact that I think Rigantino really rivals 1776 for having the longest stretch of dialogue with no music. When I was watching after the opening number and the scene went on for about 10 minutes, I thought, oh, I guess they've dropped the song. So I'm so disappointed. And then the second song came in that I knew from the album. And I thought, no, this can't be it. It's 10 minutes. Really, seriously, it seemed like there was 10 minutes between every song. It really played much more like a comedy than a musical. But it's really quite vulgar in many respects. And and unappetizing, literally, because at one point where he threw the cat, the guy catches him much later and makes him eat the cat, which is really disgusting, but not as disgusting as what happens. Oh, no. More is yet to come. The thing is that it's the theme of the show is that if you live this type of roguish life, eventually it will catch up with you, even if you're not being treated fairly. For what happens here is that Rigantino has been trying to get this woman, a married woman, to go to bed with him. Eventually she does. And of course, this doesn't please the husband very much. Well, when the husband is murdered, Rigantino just happens to be walking by, and they assume that he killed him, that it was a fight, and that's what happened. So in essence, he's going to be decapitated for something he didn't do, but in a way he's paying for all the sins he did do in the past. All right, but before they can catch him, he goes to where a friend works in a winery. So she says, well, there's an empty barrel. You can certainly, you know, hide in there. So he hides in there, and after a while he does. And I give them credit for doing something that most shows don't do. And that is the fact that they acknowledge that after a while, nature takes its course, and we all have to go to the bathroom, okay? I mean, like, it's very interesting to be in the grass harp. You know, a kid wakes up in the morning, and he sings this big song, and, you know, why hasn't he urinated? All right, well, anyway. So, well, this comes up. I mean, he keeps on complaining about the fact that he has to urinate. Well, somebody comes in to have some wine, and so as a result, he goes to the spigot, and he turns it on. And out comes this amber-colored fluid. So, and this is supposed to be funny, too, that this guy is getting, as he says a little later, it's awfully warm, isn't it? You know. So we get the impression that he is going to drink this urine thinking it's wine. But, I mean, again, vulgar, you know, I mean, really. So, frankly, I didn't see the whole thing because I had agreed to meet with two of my readers at 11:30 at night, figuring I'd definitely be on, please, you know what I mean? So I had to leave at 11:25. And because I know from the albums, I say that he gets decapitated. I'm not really giving anything away, by the way, because Rigantino is closed. It was only here for three nights. The thing is that I didn't see that happen, and I don't know how that was done. But Michael's right, lavish production, beautiful scenery, wonderful costumes, and for that matter, terrific lighting that really gives credence to sunny Italy. That was pretty good, too. The performers did their jobs, no question about it. But I really recommend for the rest of you to find that LP that was made way back when. Oh, another thing I should mention, the press on this show, it kept on saying that 50 years ago, the show played an exclusive three-week engagement on Broadway. Well, that makes it sound like a limited run. No. Alex Cohen brought it over here and expected to run on as long as Hello, Dolly. I mean, he really thought he believed in it, and he thought it was going to be this big smash hit that everybody would be so intrigued by. I always thought that it must have been better than it was based on that cast album, but now I see... No. It may be that the Italian sense of humor is substantially different from ours, and the place at City Center was packed with Italians. You could really hear, in the lobby in an intermission, and probably at the end of the show, but I wasn't there, people speaking Italian nonstop. So there was... And for that matter, when the star came on, he got recognition and applause. And later, when the first act closer, a song called Roma Nun Fa La Stupidasta Sera, started playing, it got recognition applause. People knew the song. And I have to admit, when I was in Italy in 1985, I'll tell you, I went into an Italian restaurant and the pianist was playing that song. That's when I really realized what a hit Rigantino was back in 1962 there. For the record, it ran 627 performances there, which was 599 more than it played here. So so for those of you, know, most everybody I've spoken to say, look, you know, yes, it's a terrible musical. Oh, no question. Oh, what a bad experience. Oh, my God, it's much too long. Oh, how could they do this to us? And everybody I know was also glad that he had the chance to see it. And I think that's something, at least a question mark has been answered, you know. And I was prepared for the plot to stink because I had just finished this book on the 63-64 season, and Rigantino was part of that season. And luckily, God bless my old friend Bill Martin, who saw it and gave me a playbill, and there was a 7-page, double-columned synopsis of the story in the playbill. So even though they had those super titles, which was brand new then, by the way, the fact is they didn't rely on that, and they gave that long synopsis. And, in fact... when they gave the song listing, I'm not talking about the 7 pages now. Forget about those. Forget I mentioned them. In the song listing, after each song, they even described, you know, what was happening. So they really wanted you to understand what was going on. You know, the problem is, I guess many people did understand what was going on, and that's why it closed so quickly.
Well, as Peter mentioned, it was June 12th through the 14th. So if you are going to try to see this, you're going to have to grab it on the road because it is touring around the United States.
Is it really? I had heard this was it, you know.
On their website, they have the and I only say that because the name of the website is Rigantino Tour.
Aha. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, all right.
But let's see it, and I'm going to go on the tour.
I know it's touring. This may be the only place in this country.
Oh,
yes. Not sure, yeah.
It was in Milan, it was in Florence, it was in Rome, and it was at City Center. So this is the end of the tour. Sure. You have missed it.
Uh-huh. Well, Peter, I don't know if you heard from any of the various little birds since we both left at intermission, but I heard that they cut 15 minutes from the first act between the first and second performance, which even so would still be, you know, a marathon first act. But I wonder, you know, what was cut?
Yeah.
What was cut? Why didn't they think it was necessary to cut it to begin with? How did they think that a 2-hour first act would ever be acceptable? Is a 2-hour first act for a musical comedy acceptable in Italy? It would seem so.
I guess
I mean,
so.
They've
that's
been doing
my inference.
It.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. That's my inference. And by the way, for me, it seemed to me Mm-hmm. But those Italians were theatergoers were very happy to be there. They didn't seem bored at all. They were with it. They laughed in the right places. It seemed like they were, it could very well be that that these are people for whom Italian is a first language, and they were just delighted to see something. I'm also told it wasn't even in Italian. It was something called Romanesco or something like that.
The Roman dialect. And as you allude, aside from everything, some of the, I mean, I know enough Italian to know that some of the translations were really, really kind of like broken English. You know, I mean, they were like idiomatic translations, but they didn't get
Well, my girlfriend Linda does not speak Italian. I'll tell you, she before she left at 9:30, saying, "This is it. I'm not even waiting for intermission." I thought really by 9:30, it'd be over. So she took her leave, but she said, "Boy, I can tell. You know, this is a terrible translation." And the next day, she said, "By the way, I can tell this is a terrible translation. And tomorrow, you must tell me what you see in this show." And then she left. Again, it's very hard to explain, for those.
Well, I think that a lot of if you just heard the songs, I think they're delightful and
yes,
melodic.
They are. Hear that ran 627 performances in Rome. How bad could it be? Bad, bad. That's what we learned. Bad, bad, real bad.
Yeah, you alluded to the guillotine sound. I mean, one of the major characters in this comedy is an executioner.
Yeah.
Then there was this
foreshadowing. Yeah.
Incredibly strange subplot that I couldn't really follow because, it was hard to aside from everything, to read the titles because they did what they could. They had one set of titles above the proscenium, but that's very high at City Center. And then they had another two sets on either side of the stage. So you had to make your choice whether you were going to look up or left or right, depending on where you were sitting. But every time you did, you missed looking at the stage. There was some subplot about these prostitutes or people who lure prostitutes.
Then they
throw them in the river.
Yes, that's exactly right. Two of the people who have been at the wake, need some cheering up. And as a result, they think it'd be fun to go down to where the prostitutes hang out, pretend to be prostitutes, and then, let the men know that they're not prostitutes at all and make fools of them. Yes.
And throw them in the river.
Yes. Yes. With a little help from one of the husbands. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right.
So let's just say that a lot of the humor doesn't translate.
It doesn't. I mean, because I'm telling you, those Italians were having a rollicking time.
They really were.
And, a lot of people said to me, wow, the walkouts of this intermission were just amazing. I thought that place was pretty full for the second act. Now, it may be that I did walk up to the to what I still call the first balcony during intermission to see how many people were up there. And that place was full, too. The second balcony was virtually empty. But nevertheless, the first balcony had quite a few people in it. Mm. So they got the word out. I mean, the press people really got the word out to the community who would appreciate this. And you have to give them credit for doing as well as they did, because City Center is a big place to fill. And doing as well as they did, it's not as if the Italian population here is that immense and that the people would automatically come and see this thing. But again, hearing that recognition applause for that song, again, reiterated to me, because that song never got any recordings here. Ironically enough, there was another song from the score that did get recordings here, one called Cumicella, that I know Jerry Vale did and a few other people did as well. That didn't get here's an interesting thing. In the old days, Gotthard Liebertson, who recorded for Columbia Records, occasionally used to fool around with the running order of songs because he wanted the hit song to be the first song on the second side of the record so you could hear it very easily and over again. Because it's much easier to pick up the needle and put it at the beginning of a record than it is to find, that little band in between, song 6 and 7. So anyway, for example, If Ever I Would Leave You, I think is out of sequence in Camelot because, that was the hit. Okay. Well, interestingly enough, Cumicella, I believe, was the first song on the second side of Brigantino, and it wasn't in that spot. in the show. It was earlier, so I think maybe the recording executives said, okay, let's do what Goddard does. And if that sounds odd, see if you agree with me on this, Michael. You really get the impression that these two writers came to America in the 50s, saw My Fair Lady, saw West Side Story, and say, okay, now we know how it's done. Because a lot of it sounded like West Side Story, didn't you think, in terms of the music, especially at the beginning? You didn't feel that? I hear echoes of West Side Story.
Oh, yeah. No, I did. And then that one character, well, this musical was a little later, actually, but she seemed very Aldonza-ish.
She did.
She came out.
We can't give them any slack. We can't give them any criticism on the fact that Aldonza came later because,
right.
Because really, I mean, maybe, who knows, maybe Mitch Lee went over there and saw Brigantino and said, ah, there's my Aldonza. Who knows? No, but anyway, truly one of those things we don't really see that often anymore on Broadway, and that is the magnificent disaster. And that's what this was. It really was. And if I were somebody out there listening to us today, and let's say, just for the sake of argument, in St. Louis, and I heard us talking, I would still want to go. I mean, this wouldn't deter a true musical theater aficionado at all from going to see it, because it is on the list of shows that played Broadway, and that's enough for a lot of people. But I doubt that anybody came away saying, "Wow, what a great show!" I doubt it. You know, it's just too crazy.
Well, if they could bring themselves to cut it 15 minutes of the first act for the second performance, I just wish they could have brought themselves to do it for the first one.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, if they don't think it's so sacrosanct that they couldn't touch it, you know, I mean, that really is amazing. And as you guys know, I go to the opera. But even in opera, it's like, I mean, there might be one or two Wagner operas that have 2-hour acts, but those are incredibly rare. I think in American musical theater, I think we've pretty much decided that an hour and a half is about the limit. You know, Oklahoma, I believe, has an hour and a half first act. A friend of mine insisted to me that the first act of Fiddler is an hour 45. I said, I don't think so.
I don't either. I think 90 minutes is pretty much standard for the series.
Limit, yeah.
You know, I maybe Fiddler is that long. It's never played that long, but of course it's a better show than Rigantino. So that might be the reason why, too, that we don't notice it's an hour 45. But
maybe.
But yeah, you know, I mean, really. However, again, that audience there seemed to be happy it was getting more for its money. That's the way it seemed to me, you know,
right.
You know, because I mean, I'm sure there are people, and I don't blame them, saying, I just paid $162 for a seat and I'm out at 9:30. Are you kidding me? You know, so I understand that point of view, too. That, you know, so you do get more for your money with Rigantino, whether you liked it or not.
Well, I hope that, you know, was it Second Stage that had a wine sponsor? Was it Second Stage? Maybe Rigantino also had a wine sponsor, but you guys didn't get it. I'm not sure. But Rigantino shows us that the problems of musical theater are cross nations' boundaries, because we very often hear the phrase, the music was very good, the book was the problem.
True.
And Rigantino, you know, three nights international, you're in, you're out, they're collecting the money, they're gone. It almost makes you think that they were a fly-by-night organization, weren't they?
Well, I'll tell you, what doesn't make it seem fly-by-night was the lavishness of the sets, the costumes. And again, I'll give credit to the lighting as well for really making it look like Italy. I had much more respect for the Evita movie for really capturing Argentina after I had gone to Buenos Aires, and I watched the movie again, and the lighting really captured what it was like. I know it wasn't filmed there, but the lighting really captured it. So good lighting when it replicates a country's which is famous for lighting. I mean, after all, sunny Italy, right? That's an idiom. Mm-hmm. It was nice and sunny.
Well, we're going to talk about this a little bit later, but how did the sound sound to you?
fine.
Well, but again, you know, I just, did you have any idea, Peter, that it was going to be tracks instead of an orchestra?
No, that was not made clear to me at all. I never read anything about that, you know, but it certainly became very apparent to me early on that I was desperately looking for a guy in the pit, you know, waving his arms, but I knew I wasn't going to find one.
I do think, again, even taking into account all the realities, I just think that's really, really, a really bad thing. You know, it has become accepted in some dance performances.
Yes, it has.
But yeah. I don't think in this country, certainly, that it really has become acceptable in any professional musical theater performances. And I hope it doesn't.
I wonder.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how they got away with that. I guess it was just a rental of City Center.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure.
But it's still a union house, and they probably still had union people put in the set. And yeah. Anyway, we'll have to figure that out. But you missed my wonderful transition to Fly By Night at Playwrights Horizons that Peter saw. And so, Peter, why don't you tell us about Fly By Night?
I truly believe that the next show these people do is going to be astonishing. They show tremendous potential, and I wish them very well, especially Michael Mitnick, who got in touch with me out of the blue many moons ago when he was simply a high school student. And I wouldn't have my demo of 1776 if it weren't for Michael, who was also, by the way, I remember vividly, named one of the most astonishing high school seniors by USA Today. I remember seeing his name and picture on the front page. So anyway, he's teamed up with Will Connolly and Kim Rosenstock, a TV writer of some note, and they've created this original musical. I will admit that I knew where it was going because I'm a date freak, and they mentioned a date, and that date turns out to be very significant to the plot. I'm Ben Brantley gave away in the review what that date was, and I don't think that's quite fair, but just for the sake of argument, I'm not going to tell you the date, but I'm going to give you the concept. It's as somebody, the narrator says, this show starts on January 3rd, 1921, and ends on January 3rd, 1922. Those are not the dates, but the point is a year goes by in the life of these people, much as it does in Rent. It starts with a husband and a son losing, respectively, the wife and mother, and how that impacts these two guys for the rest of the show. But the event that happens a year later is something that impacted many, many, many millions of people when it actually happened. But, you know, even though I knew that was coming, I'm telling you, one of the most clever things I have ever seen in terms of a person committing suicide was just amazing. A tremendous plot twist, and these people really show that they have an ability to come up with something totally unexpected, worthy of O. Henry's short story. So the show's too long, not as long as Rigantino, what is, but it's too long. And I will say that one of the problems is that the main character of Harold, the son who lost his mother, is a little too namby-pamby, and he doesn't have any ambition that I can see. Now, he does hook up with a woman who comes from South Dakota who's come to New York to be a big musical theater star. The show takes place in the 60s, by the way, and I would love for her to have a song that sounds like a 60s musical. They haven't given her that. They've given her more of a pop rock song. But if you want to be a musical comedy star in the 60s, you should have an establishing song that sounds as if that's your medium. So I'd like to see that happen. Patty Murin, by the way, is terrific as this South Dakota expatriate named Daphne. She comes with her sister, equally wonderful, Allison Case. Terrific. Both ladies are magnificent. And here's a woman who has no ambition either, but she's very, very content to be a waitress, much like the woman in Working who sings It's an Art. She's just into it. She likes it. She's very happy about it. And she doesn't want to move to New York particularly, but she wants to be supportive to her sister. And the adventures they have here are pretty compelling, actually, I would say. That part of the show is very well written. There's a nice laugh from the audience when Daphne is reading play after play after play, And she says, there are so many wonderful roles for women. And the audience laughed because, it's not necessarily the case that many other people share. In fact, when I emceed the Theatre World Awards this year, I mentioned the fact, and this is true, 122 men were eligible. 66 women were eligible. So that tells you something right there. Yes, there are almost twice as many eligible men as eligible women, just like the city's dating pool. You know, it's the same type of thing. So anyway, you know, Harold makes half-hearted attempts to be a folk singer, you know. But even there, there's one of those moments where, you know, he says, everybody sing with me, you know, and I hate that type of thing. I can't stand it. But anyway, this is something that's demanded of you. And later you find out that there's a reason that you were singing along. They wanted that melody ingrained in your head because that melody will turn out to be significant later. And if it were not ingrained in your head, you would miss an important plot point. See, so I mean, I'm telling you, these guys are really good in setting up things that you think are not significant. Yeah, they're just part of the show. Yeah, all right, fine. You know, they threw it in there. No, they didn't. to say a line that I love, which was originally said by Inspector Clouseau, of all people, every move I make is carefully planned. Well, that's what's true of these people. So I think that's they unlike Inspector Clouseau, they really make good on that. Every move they make is carefully planned. So I'll tell you, Peter Friedman playing the father has a song that is so wonderful and so moving that seriously, after the orchestra played the button, and it took a second for the audience to applaud. You know how that happens. I heard this loud sniff come from a spectator that he or she was so moved by the song that had to choke back a tear. It really was something. Michael McCormack, by the way, is also in this, a wonderful actor. He plays Harold's long-suffering boss, you know, because this is the day job, and the guy has no interest in it whatsoever. But really, this is a show that excites you and saying, okay, I can't wait to see what these three people do next. And I bet they work out the bugs and they've learned a lot from this. The reviews have not been raves. And I just hope that they don't get discouraged as a unit. And I hope that in the meeting they had after the reviews came out that they weren't singing "It's Your Fault" from Into the Woods. You know, I just hope that that it's a case of all right. You know, this worked, this didn't work. You know, let's learn from this and let's go on. But music's wonderful. I'll tell you, I'm really. They all seem to work on everything. There's no real specific division of labor duties here. But this is an album that I think would rule my CD player. Yes, I still use CDs for months. I truly believe that. So, and the lyrics are intelligent and all that goes with this. So, but I wouldn't mind if they took a leaf out of Rigantino's book and cut, you know, 15 minutes out too. So they also, the use of the narrator too, I think was a little pretentious. And it reminded me of a play. I don't know if you know this play called The Pavilion. It seemed like they were very influenced by, I don't know if they saw this play, but the narrator uses the same type of feeling and seems to have the same type of value of almost like orchestrating what goes on. And then the moon comes in, you know, that type of thing. I really think if they had dispensed with the narrator and just told the story, it would have been much better. But if I may cast my three electoral votes, I would say that these are terrific, wonderful young writers, and I'm counting the days like a kid till Christmas till the next show.
Great. So hopefully we will see a recording from you from them. Was there any announcement that there will be a recording?
I didn't notice one. That doesn't mean that brings up a good question. I was wondering, when was the last time any new musical took an ad that said original cast album by blah, blah, blah records. You know, I mean, that used to be so common. And I just wonder what the last one was. I mean, was it 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago? I just wonder, you know, but there was a time when you looked at any ad for any musical and you would be sure to see original cast album by, if indeed they had one. I mean, you know, like some shows like The Education of Hyman Kaplan, for example, didn't have a deal. So as a result, you certainly didn't see it there. But most full page ads in the Times for the new musical coming in, believe me, said original cast album by. So I don't know if they have a deal. I hope they do.
So this is at Playwrights Horizons through June 29th on the main stage. And we'll have links to it in the show notes if you want to check it out. Some great videos and photos from the production as well on the Playwrights Horizons website. So in the news this week, we have a handful of things to talk about before we wrap up. News, I guess it was yesterday, that After Midnight has announced that they are closing on June 29th. And it will leave the theater open, some say for Honeymoon in Vegas, but the Honeymoon in Vegas people have been remarkably quiet about this. I'd imagine, you know, and the first thing I did when everybody was talking about it in Honeymoon in Vegas, is I went to Jason Robert Brown's Facebook page, and all these people are commenting on it. And Jason is really big in social media. He talks all the time. Not a peep happening from Jason Robert Brown yesterday, although he did move from the Upper West Side down to the Village yesterday. So,
Oh, really?
That might be there as well.
He was otherwise engaged. Right?
Otherwise engaged, but I'm sure that they are just waiting for an official announcement, so he is not confirming or denying anything. So we'll see.
Are you sure he moved, James, or is this a case where he got another apartment to store his Tonys that he has and will get in the future? Maybe that's it.
You know, there were clever comments about where the Tony's going to go in the new apartment, so... Yeah, he moved up from 86 down to the Village. So it'd be fun to see what's going to happen there. But, I mean, I'd love to see Honeymoon in Vegas come in. And
it would be very nice in the Atkinson as well. However, I imagine the reason we're not hearing from them is because they want a bigger theater. So you know, just to make money. But it is the type of show that would really play very well in the Atkinson, and I hope it happens. And Rob McClure is perfect in it. No other word will do. Perfect. Not one false move in his performance. He was magnificent in the show at Paper Mill, and I certainly wish the show a lot of luck, and I hope to see it soon. But in terms of After Midnight, I don't know. I'm sure that most of us would feel that they got much more of a run than we expected when it opened. At least I didn't think it was going to run this long. I expected it would have closed Christmas week because I just didn't think it was that compelling or interesting a show. But it found an audience for a while. And if it's true that one of the unions wouldn't play ball with them when they had to take a week off, then that's really too bad because they might have lasted a little longer. But all things considered, I think we have to look at the glasses half full rather than half empty for After Midnight's run.
I spoken to several people who were very surprised because we all felt that the number from After Midnight was one of the best numbers on the Tonys.
That's right.
As far as how well it came over and the audience response, and as far as what we perceived would sell tickets.
Mm-hmm.
I had read that they were never. It was always called sort of like a soft hit. Is that the word?
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, it was never like selling all that well,
right.
Or maybe
yeah.
It had times when it was and then times when it wasn't. And
yeah.
And so when you're on a borderline like that, I guess anything like not being able to take off for a week, which does sound, you know, sort of counterproductive for whatever union might have not agreed to that, doesn't it? I mean, so you...
It does.
Because
we don't know all the ins and outs of what that means. You
right.
know, they may be afraid of setting a precedent and all that goes with that. So,
Yeah.
But I'm all for concessions, but it's easy for me to say because I'm not part of the union.
Well, and I don't know if James, if this is what you were specifically referring to, but the New York Times article says two theater executives said that After Midnight would be followed at the Brooks Atkinson by the new musical Honeymoon in Vegas, which had a critically acclaimed run last year at the Paper Mill Playhouse. Honeymoon in Vegas is expected to start performances at the Atkinson this fall, said the theater executives, who spoke upon under condition of anonymity to disclose the confidential plans. A spokesman for the Honeymoon in Vegas producers said on Saturday that they could not confirm a theater or performance schedule. So it may just come down to the contracts not being signed.
Yeah.
That's what it sounds like to me. Yeah.
Well, Rob McClure was one of my presenters and, in fact, entertained, too, sang the opening number of Honeymoon in Vegas at the Theater World Awards. And at least as of June 8th, he believed the show was going to open in the spring. So it may very well be that once this window of opportunity opened up, that but the fact that he told me the spring not that long ago would suggest to me that they are seizing the opportunity to go into the Atkinson. That's my inference, nothing more. But and frankly, I hope to see it sooner rather than later. Yeah, I think it's a good idea. You know, I mean, I have it on good authority that Fun Home is taking Circle in the Square, and they're going to open very close to the Tony cutoff date, and because they feel we just need that momentum, we need every break we can get because we're a Maverick type of show. So Honeymoon Invasion is not a Maverick type show, and it's certainly a tired businessman show, and that, I mean, that is a compliment, seriously. So it may very well do very well during the fall and even the winter. So
I completely agree, and as I've said before, I'm all for shows opening in the fall when they don't need to open right before the Tonys, because for the reasons you stated, I think it got almost ridiculous this spring, and again sometimes we phrase it as how spread thin we are, and I of course I agree with Peter that it's not all about us and it's first world problems.
Yeah, sure.
But I also think that it's not good for the shows because there's less attention on each one. I mean, you're not even done reacting to one before you have to go, everyone has to react to another one. And I don't just mean the critics, I mean the public So I think that would be great. And also, I'm sure we can think of many cases where as soon as the closing of one show is announced, immediately the opening of another show in that theater is announced. But that doesn't mean it happens all the time. And that doesn't mean we should expect it to happen all the time. I imagine that it was a surprise. Well, it sounds like it was a surprise to them that After Midnight is closing, because maybe they thought they would get that concession for the July 4th week. And maybe they thought there would be a tremendous bump at the box office for the Tonys that didn't happen. So I think maybe they were almost blindsided in that respect, and so it was a surprise.
Well, it's usually that summer business is good for musicals, and that certainly they could have coasted. If they had a little bit of bump at the box office, they could have coasted, especially with the stars that were coming in through the Thanksgiving and Christmas holiday, and then closed for the winter, and that would have brought Honeymoon in Vegas in the spring, as Rob McClure inferred. So,
By the way, excuse my ignorance, but this specific concession they wanted was to temporarily shut down over the July 4th week. Is that generally considered a horrible week?
I don't really know historically, but isn't July 4th falling in the middle of the week this year? And it's kind of... It's not great for anything.
Well, I imagine the holiday. Did they?
Is July 4th is Friday. It's Friday.
Uh huh. I've never noticed a particular drop off in business during July 4th.
If anything, you would think there might be even more people here to see the fireworks. And then you could theoretically go to a show and then see the fireworks. And plus, people who are here to see the fireworks would see shows on other nights. So I don't know. It just surprised me that.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's not. Maybe there was a specific reason. Maybe they couldn't.
Oh, no. I think that they had a break between the stars.
It does say that, yes.
Yeah, there was a star that was ending and a star that was starting, and they couldn't.
I'm reading it now. Between scheduled guest star appearances by Patti LaBelle and Gladys Knight.
Yeah. That was it.
So they had no star lineup for that week. Yes. Okay. Thank you.
So and we have seen shows that have gone on temporary hiatus.
Yeah.
Although I don't know for a week. So
Boy from Oz did, of course, when he went on vacation.
Right. Famous example.
Oh, that's right. You're totally right. Yeah. So was Rob McClure in that one too?
No, but Peter's point is, I mean, in that sense, this would not be a precedent. But who knows? As Peter also says, who knows what else specifically went into the decision? Maybe I'll see if I can.
This is a very confusing business, and sometimes things just don't make any sense. And I think that next year maybe we just won't have a sound Tony.
Sometimes things don't make any sense even when we have all the information, and when we don't have all the information then they really don't make any sense. but the sound Tony, which I it's funny, I as soon as I heard that they were eliminating it, I was trying to remember just off the top of my head, and I said to someone, when was it instituted? Because I know that it wasn't, there wasn't,
it was like
back in the
years.
Do you know, I said something like maybe the late 70s, early 80s. No, it was 2005.
Yeah, 8 years ago or something like that. Yeah. So the Tony committee shuffled out a bunch of announcements right after the awards last week. And one of them was that there was going to be no longer a Tony Award for sound design in a play or in a musical. They also made a change that authors whose shows were not on Broadway previously but are in the revival category, like Hedwig, the authors would be eligible for the Tony as well as the producers in the revival category. Did I get that correct?
Oh, so it's still going to be the award for best musical, but
best revival.
Best revival, but the award will go to the authors as well as the producers.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds.
I think it should be it should go to them if indeed they have not won for this show before. I mean, they're not going to give, if there's a revival of Fiddler next year, that's terrific. They're not going to give Jerry Bach a posthumous Tony and Sheldon Harnick one too. I think it should be just in these circumstances where the show has never played Broadway but has been around for a while. I mean, I was not in favor of Violet and Hedwig being in the best musical category just because they haven't been on Broadway, because they've been around. I mean, so I don't think that should happen. But it's fine with me if indeed the authors were to get Tonys for a show that had never been produced on Broadway before. I think that should happen.
And Michael, go ahead.
Oh, and did you want to mention that other little change that they apparently made that
the merchandising change? I was going to let you talk because I started to think that I had it backwards. So the merchandising change is that they are now allowing people to give.
It's a reversal, I guess. And I got all this secondhand and didn't actually read it anywhere, but I understand that until around the time of Spamalot, apparently, and I think it was Avenue Q around then.
First campaign, the really big,
You bet.
Before that, producers were able to send all this swag to Tony voters. And I do remember the Spamalot bag because I was a Tony voter at that time briefly. And it was, I mean, it wasn't like it was, a Rolex watch or anything, but it was really cute. It had a bag that had a can of Spam in it, and it had those coconuts that they use to make the horse sounds and other fun little things like that. But I don't think this rule was really targeted at that. It was also apparently there were shows giving parties, with lots of wonderful food and drink, and like basically plying the voters with drink and food and swag in an effort to sway their votes. And then someone decided that this should stop, and so the rule was passed that the only they were severely limiting what the producers could could send out, and I think it was only limited to a cast recording and a script. I think that's only what they were allowed to do. And in fact, I'm not a Tony voter now, but I did get a script. Well, let's see. I guess you can get a program also. I got for Beautiful. I got the program
and the vinyl.
Yes, the vinyl LP, which a lot of people are very excited about. Just for some reason. I mean, one could argue that it's arbitrary to have a sound design award for 6 years and then suddenly decide that that's not necessary. In the same way that one could argue it's completely arbitrary to limit the swag and the parties and things like that, and then suddenly decide, oh, maybe we don't have to do that after all. I don't know what changed in both cases. And in the case of the sound design award, apparently they gave literally no reason for it, not even boilerplate language or anything. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So your guess is as good as ours. Mm-hmm.
So the other announcement, but I really didn't see it talked about much, was the announcement of the new committee for the 14 and 15 nominations. So did you guys hear that?
Yeah, Cheyenne yes. Jackson.
Yeah, Cheyenne Jackson, Mary Louise Parker, who
Harvey Evans.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Harvey Evans.
I'll know what he's doing though. Yeah. There should be more people like Harvey Evans on this committee because he knows his onions.
Did you see that thing that blew up on Facebook with Harvey last week?
I came to it belatedly. Maybe you should talk about it because I.
Well, it seemed that Harvey had had talked a little bit about the Tony Awards, and he got a bunch of blowback on it because someone didn't agree with what he had said about the way in which the best musical, I think it was best musical, was picked or something along those lines. And
I think it had to do with the speech, the acceptance speech.
Yeah, the acceptance speech. Yeah. But it was interesting that that all happened, and then all of a sudden, Harvey was put on the nominating committee.
Yes.
So,
but we want people who care, right?
Oh, absolutely.
We want people who, yes, yeah. No, I think he's a wonderful choice.
So the nominated committee has got 50 members in it for the 14-15 season, And
I was told, now this represents how much of an increase? I believe something
I thought it was 33 for a while, so.
Yeah, I think it's a dramatic increase.
Mm-hmm. And I was told that part of the reason for the increase is that they have had multiple occasions where people had to recuse themselves.
Ah, yes.
Due to conflict of interest, which, at least let's be thankful that people have the integrity to recuse themselves, mm-hmm. Rather than being made to recuse themselves. But you could see why that would be an issue.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, And so I will put a link on that, the new members, in the show notes as well, if you want to check that out and read up on it. And then the last thing we'll talk about today is that the Encores made their announcement for their 2015 season, mm-hmm. With Lady Be Good, Paint Your Wagon, and Zorba. So I'm going to say that among the circle of people that I talk with, they're really excited about this season. What do you guys think?
Yes.
Go ahead, Michael.
Well, and let me say from the beginning that just a few days earlier we had been reading that it was not going to be Paint Your Wagon, it was going to be Do I Hear a Waltz, which that would have excited me even more, just because I've always thought that from what I could tell that show is better than people give it credit for. And I would have loved to see because the only actual production I saw was at the George Street Playhouse some years ago. And it was pretty good overall. Penny Fuller was was fantastic in the lead. Mm-hmm. But I recall, and I don't know it that well to begin with, so I can't tell you how much, but I recall that there were some kind of revisions involved by Arthur Lawrence himself. So it wasn't, you know, the actual 100% what was on Broadway. So I was really looking forward to seeing, you know, presumably they would have done the original, that might have been why they didn't do it, because it might have been a problem with the Lawrence estate. It could have been a problem with Sondheim, but if it was a problem with Sondheim, I think then they wouldn't even have gotten to the point of them saying they were going to do it.
Whether Richard Rodgers and Stephen Sondheim like it or not, the fact remains they wrote a very good score together.
Thank you.
It's terrific. I saw the original Do I Hear a Waltz, and I liked it quite a bit. I will admit I was very young at the time, and looking at it now, I certainly see flaws I didn't see then. But it was a lovely production, but I still think it's a terrific score. It's an album I listen to quite a bit and I'm very happy with. So I'm sort of sorry it isn't that. Of course, from a personal standpoint, I'm always sorry when encores shows that I've seen before, you know, and these three happen to be shows I've seen before. And so, yeah, I'm not as excited. But aside from me, and it's not all about me, this is a good lineup. The question becomes, Zorba was announced a few years ago with Antonio Banderas, and one is wondering if this is a way of jump-starting that. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying we're going to see him in the Encores production, but I wonder if there will be a reassessment, if this is sort of like a strange type of out-of-town tryout for Zorba to see if it can work and get enough interest that people would actually buy tickets to it 8 times a week. So very nice score. In fact, as many people get out, the Greek score that John Kander wrote for Zorba seems to be more Greek than the one that the Greek gentleman Manos Hadjidakis wrote for Ilya Darling 2 years earlier. So, that John Kander, I mean, he really is terrific. This is going to please a lot of people because that really is a solid score. I have great problems with Zorba as a musical, though I don't agree with Ethan Morton, who I usually agree with quite a bit. When he refers to Zorba in his 60s book, Open a New Window, as an evil piece of shit. That's a quote, by the way. But all things considered, it is a good choice because the score is going to be wonderful and having that orchestra on stage playing it, which is almost going to replicate what happened in the original production, because at least the opening scene was set in a restaurant where people were sitting around playing bouzoukis and what have you. So it's going to look like the opening number is going to look like what it did originally, even inadvertently. So Paint Your Wagon, sure, wonderful score. Again, a book that isn't very good. So let's hear the music, which is really solid. A lot of people only know the movie, which is their misfortune. So that's a problem. And yeah, always getting a Gershwin show to see again, or to see for the first time. Lady Be Good, of course, has terrific music. You don't need me to tell you that. But, the title song certainly is a standard. And but fascinating rhythm. If it's done, it was done originally. I'm telling you, that's going to be quite a production number, because on the None Such album that came out some years ago, that fascinating rhythm intoxicated me for months. It's 7 minutes and 31 seconds, but it built beautifully. And I hope that they do it exactly as it was done back then. Also, there are some wonderful little moments that people don't talk about very much, like the Half of It Deary Blues that I'd Rather Charleston. Those are very good songs, too. So we'll get a chance to hear them before we hear the other two shows.
Well, in related news, it just has been announced that Antonio Banderas and his wife, Melanie Griffith, are splitting. I don't know if that will impact either way his chances of appearing in the show. But it seems to me that I wouldn't be surprised if he does it, because he was so great in Nine, and I think he loves doing live theater. And I it's obviously the commitment to encores is much less to a Broadway run, although unless it's assumed that one would absolutely, you know, lead to the other. But I think that would be great. I'd love to see him in it, even if, I mean, he's, I would say, quite different from some of the other people who played the role, but he is he's getting older, as are the rest of us. And it would be interesting to see how they, what they do in terms of that, how old they make him appear to be on stage. And I'm not exactly sure how old the character is supposed to be. Do you know, Peter?
Zorba himself?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think
50?
In the 40s. Yeah, 40s, 50s. You know, he does talk about getting married and having children. The entire catastrophe, I think, is the word he used for getting married and having children. Mm-hmm. But I somewhere around there. I don't even know how old Anthony Quinn was when he played the role. I'm talking in the movie in 64. Mm-hmm. I don't mean the revival in 83. But I don't know how old he was. But he seemed to me at the time to be in his 40s or 50s. So.
I think Quinn was considerably older, but Herschel Bernardi, when he did the original, couldn't have been much older than 45 or 50, you know, 50 at most, I would say. So, my point is that in the past, you know, I mean, we all think of people like Antonio Banderas as, you know, because he was so young when he came out as a big star. I think we all tend to think of him that way, but you know, time goes on and we'll see.
It's always amazing to find out that people who we think are so young today doing revivals turn out to be older than the people who originated the art. That happens quite a bit. The one thing I've never understood about Zorba, in 1968, when Zorba was being produced, it was also when London Cabaret was happening, and cast in the Lottie Lenny role was Lila Kadrova, who played Madame Hortense in the movie of Zorba, the Greek. So I often wondered why Hal Prince didn't use her in the musical of version of Zorba. That makes no sense to me that he had that. And obviously she did it many years later and won a Tony. So how bad could she have been? So I'm very surprised he didn't use her, especially I hate to tell tales out of school, but I will, since both people are gone. I was told that when Herschel Bernardi and Maria Kanilova were doing Fiddler, they didn't get along at all. So I don't know why you put them together again. Again, this is hearsay. I have no idea if this is true. I only tell you what I hear. I have no idea if it's true or not. But if it is, it's a little strange that that would be Hal Prince's casting decisions. So,
Peter, when have you seen Lady Be Good? And do you feel that any of the productions you've seen were more or less the original versions?
Oh, I don't know about that. I guess the first one I saw was actually at Harvard University in the 70s. And
okay.
And that struck me as boilerplate original.
But certainly you will admit that that Lady Be Good, even though you happen to have seen,
absolutely,
yeah.
As I say, it's not all about me, you know. I mean, but you know, all of us, you know, relish the chance to see shows we haven't seen before. So that's all I'm saying, you know.
No, yeah, but what I meant was Zorba did have a Broadway revival.
Yeah,
Paint Your Wagon. No, I saw Paint Your Wagon at Musicals Tonight.
I feel it's terrific, by the way.
Yes, and I saw it at Goodspeed. Uh-huh. But there again, I don't follow that closely. I believe that there was at least two or three different versions of the script.
Famously, in fact, in Theater Arts magazine, after the show had closed, they printed the revised script, which everybody says is much better. So, but again, it's about the music, and you know, well, who knows if it'll be about the music. I mean, these shows and encores have turned out to be, you know, virtual productions now as time has gone on. So we may hear substantially more of the dialogue than we would have way back 20 years ago.
Yeah.
All right. So let's wrap it up. Either one of you have something you want to throw in before we go?
I think I'm done.
Yeah, me too. I'm seeing Much Ado About Nothing at the Delacorte. So really
beautiful night for that.
Yeah.
You're going to have some good weather tonight. All right. So maybe, does that officially open up this week?
No, I think it just started, actually. And you know, those shows tend to run for a while before they officially
open. They officially open just as they're closing.
Yeah. Sort of, yeah.
Yeah, so we won't be able to truly talk about that next week, but we'll find something to talk about, I think, about.
Yeah.
All right, so I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe button there. Each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. You don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can also listen to us in the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device. Or listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. I'd like you to do me a favor, if you can, get over to iTunes, whether or not you subscribe there, but leave us a review, because good reviews on iTunes will help other people find us. You don't have to just be in the United States. We get reviews on iTunes all over the world. So wherever you are listening to us from, if you would leave us a review at iTunes, that would be great for us. Contact information for Peter, Michael, or me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.